You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Carrie Lutz. Special guest with us today, hasn't been on the show much recently. Somebody who I've known for over a decade now. Hard to believe, been doing this on my 12th year now. But Peter Schiff is with us. Peter, hey, great to have you back. And well, the world is getting more complicated by the day. What is your take on what's happening in the world and particularly the economies, the global economy?
It's kind of an open-ended question that would take a long time to answer. There's certainly a lot of stuff going on in the world. But I don't think my take has really changed over the decade or so that I know you. I think it goes back further than that. I think I've known you maybe 20 years or more. I'm not really.
Yeah,
sure.
A long time.
But yeah, you know, financial survival, I think, is the name of the game, although it hasn't been too difficult in recent decades to survive. We've had a big bubble. And so the people who have been invested have done well. But I do think that the bubble's going to pop. I think a lot of air is going to come out. And I think there may not be many survivors financially anyway. But I think that I'll be among them. I mean, that's been my strategy. I think my clients, to the extent that they're following my advice, will end up doing well. But I've been warning for many, many years that the path that we're on, the fiscal path, the money printing, would lead to disaster. And I still believe that that's the case. I think it's even a bigger disaster now than what I was worried about a decade or two ago, because all of the imbalances have gotten much worse. We're far more indebted now as a people, as a nation, than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, 2 years ago. You pick the time frame. The national debt's $31.5 trillion and rising, and that's just the funded portion. The unfunded portion is much larger. We have the largest trade deficits we've ever had, far larger than they were when I first started worrying about them, back then. The economy is far more out of balance and dysfunctional now than it ever was. And we're headed for a much bigger crisis. I mean, we had some, test runs along the way. We had the 2008 financial crisis, kind of a warm up for what's coming. You know, we had what we experienced, with COVID. But that was pretty tame stuff, I think, compared to where we're headed. When we get the ultimate crisis, which is going to be a U.S. dollar and a sovereign debt crisis. And we're certainly a lot closer to that than we've ever been. Exactly how many days or years we have left, I certainly can't guess. But the number is a lot shorter than it used to be. That's for sure.
Yeah, the debt clock is ticking away before our very eyes. When you look, I had David Stockman on the show, guy who I followed for a long time. I asked him, what is your biggest regret from your Washington days? And you know what he told me? He said that we didn't push for sound money because he was always a sound money.
And Reagan was a sound money guy too. But and the other thing, the other thing that they've got to regret is they didn't cut any spending. I mean, Ronald Reagan ran a good campaign, at least the first one, against Jimmy Carter. You know, getting rid of the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, and those departments hadn't even been around very long. In fact, the Department of Energy was started by Jimmy Carter. So it seems that, back then was the time to get rid of it. But, it's still here. It hasn't produced a barrel of oil, but it's still here. We've spent a lot of money, wasted a lot of money on that department. But, they should have cut government spending. They did a good job with, reforming the tax code and reducing the marginal rates of taxation. I mean, that was a positive, but they didn't cut government. Government kept getting bigger and bigger. And of course, now, I mean, it's growing even faster. Of course, Biden did the State of the Union yesterday and bragged about how he was cutting the deficit. Of course, he didn't cut anything. We had the the biggest deficits now. I mean, you can't just compare it to that 1 year that we had COVID, which was complete craziness. But you compare the Biden deficits to the Trump deficits before COVID, and they're much bigger. You know, I thought it was rich that Biden was criticizing Trump for increasing the national debt by 25% in one term, right, which was a quarter of all the entire national debt. Well, when he was in office with Obama, during their two terms, they doubled the national debt. So, you know, they increased the national debt by more than every single president, or about the same, rather, as every president from George Washington to George Bush. You know, so how you could, you know, the pot called the kettle black in that situation.
Yeah, but hypocrisy.
Yeah, but look, at least look, he's correct to criticize Trump, but he's not the one to criticize him, you know, because he's got blood on his hands. I criticize both of them. I criticize the deficits under Bush, and then I criticize them under Trump. And so I have a right to criticize them, certainly under Biden, because I'm not a hypocrite, or I don't accept the deficits when they're the Republicans, but oppose them when it's the Democrats. I oppose them all the time. But I can say objectively that when it comes to deficits, the Democrats are on balance even worse than the Republicans, but they both fail. None of them are any good.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, none of them pass my class in fiscal responsibility. Yeah. Everybody gets an F.
Yeah.
Maybe the Democrats just get an F minus, if you can have an F minus.
They earned it. They earned it. They didn't just get it. They actually went out of their way to get that grade. You know, we see inflation. I don't know about you. We hadn't talked, but in the beginning of the pandemic, I knew the inflation was coming. Well, you start just giving out bushels of money, and then around the world, you shut down production, and then you can't figure out why you can't buy a car. It was coming. What'd you do to cash in on that trend?
Well, first of all, you know, I've been talking about inflation again for 10, 20 years. I mean, it's been a problem. We've been in denial of the inflation problem. One of the reasons we've been able to deny it is because we don't measure it accurately. So all the years that the government kept telling us inflation is 2% or lower, it was actually quite a bit higher than that, but we weren't measuring it properly. But it went off the charts in the aftermath of COVID. And I, you know, I'm not a Monday morning quarterback. I remember March of 2020 when the Fed announced this QE infinity program with COVID and we drop rates. On my podcasts, and all those podcasts are up there. I mean, I don't edit them. You can go listen to my podcasts from March of 2020 and April and May and all that. And I was saying that this was the worst possible combination of monetary and fiscal policy I'd ever seen, the most inflationary combination of policy, that the correct monetary policy would have been to shrink the money supply because everybody was staying at home and not working. So economic activity was contracting, production was contracting. We needed to contract the money supply along with the good supply. If we didn't do that, you know, prices were going to rise. But we did the worst possible thing. Instead of contracting the money supply along with the economy, we expanded it even faster. We basically told people to stay at home and don't work, don't produce anything, but here's a bunch of money to go out and buy stuff. Buy what? They weren't making anything.
Amazon.
And in fact, we gave a lot of people more money not to work than what they earned when they did work. And of course, when they worked, they were at least productive. When they sat at home, they produced nothing. But they were getting paid more to produce nothing than they earned producing something. So I said this was a disaster, that prices were going to skyrocket. And that's exactly what's happened. And we're not nearly done with it. We still have a long way to go on the upside when it comes to prices. And I think what we're experiencing now is just, you know, a bit of a trough. And so the lull before the next storm. This is what's transitory, this decline in inflation, disinflation, which is how Powell described it. This is transitory. I think before the end of the year, we're going to start to be surprised once again, the way the Fed was in 2021 by how strong inflation comes roaring back. Not that it ever went away, but the improvement's going to go away and we're going to start to see even worse data than what we saw last year.
Yeah, and it was dreadful. I mean, look, you're working class, blue collar, you know, the working poor. This inflation is about the worst thing that could ever happen to you. When people, even upper middle class, sit in their ivory towers and say, well, you know, it's declining, things are getting better. Those people, the lower income earners, have already been dramatically damaged. Not to mention, if you got to feed a family of four on a paycheck, it's really tough out there. And I don't think you know, the more well-off people really understand the damage that these policies have wrought.
Well, right. And of course, when you talk about it, you don't even want to talk about the damage and blame it on inflation and say inflation is causing all this harm among working class people. It's not inflation. It's the government that's doing it, because it's the government that's creating the inflation. So it's the government that is harming working class people. And how are they doing that? By paying for government spending through inflation rather than through legitimate taxation. Because all these programs that guys like President Biden like so much cost a lot of money. And nobody wants to raise taxes to pay for the programs. Now, of course, they'd love to raise taxes on the rich. You know, that's easy because there's not that many rich people who vote. I mean, in relationship to everybody else. But the rich are already paying a lot of tax and, you know, they're not going to pay much more. So to the extent that you really want all this government, you've got to make the middle class and the working poor pay for it. But they can't afford it. They can barely afford to support themselves, let alone all these government programs. So what the politicians do is they say, well, we're just going to print money. We're just going to run deficits. And that's how we're going to pay for these programs. And that causes prices to go up. And so when people are struggling to pay the rising cost of food or shelter or insurance or everything else, that is the tax. Those higher prices is how they're paying for all these government programs. And so if the cost of paying for those programs is imposing hardship on the public, it's the government's fault. And if the government cared about the people, they would cut spending to relieve the public of the burden of paying for all those programs.
Yeah, well, in an ideal world, but the average person doesn't really even understand where inflation comes from. They think inflation is strictly higher prices.
Yes.
They don't understand Milton Friedman.
Yeah, and that's not an accident. That is by design. Everybody wants the public to misunderstand inflation. In fact, inflation is probably the most misunderstood term in the English language. You know, it doesn't mean rising prices. It means an expansion of the money supply. Rising prices is just a potential consequence of inflation, but it is not inflation. But the reason that so many people believe that a consequence of inflation is in fact inflation is because the government, which creates the inflation, wanted to blame it on other people. And so once you redefine inflation as rising prices, well, then you can blame it at Putin. You can say, well, Putin's the reason that prices are going up. Or you can blame it on greedy businesses that are profiteering and gouging their customers. But when you properly define inflation, then you can't do that. It's obvious who's causing inflation if it's an expansion of the money supply, because it's the government that expands the money supply. It's not corporations. Putin can't expand our money supply. Only we can do that. So we cause the inflation, and it's not going to go away because we're continuing to cause more inflation. In fact, the president referred again yesterday to the Inflation Reduction Act. The Inflation Reduction Act is an act to increase inflation. That's what the act does. It spends money that the government doesn't collect in taxes. It's expansionary policy. It is inflationary by design. It is just a lie. You know, president was all upset last night because hotels want to charge resort fees. Oh, that's not fair. You know, that's bad marketing. I mean, compare that to what the government does, you know, with how they label their legislation. Look, if you don't like resort fees, just don't stay in hotels that charge them. I mean, it's ridiculous. The problem is if you don't like your taxes, you got to pay them. You don't have any choice. Instead of worrying about the $25 resort fee, you know, why don't they worry about the thousands of dollars that families are paying in the income tax and the inflation tax? Do something about that. Forget about airlines and hotels, you know, because that's got the government's, that's none of the government's business. You know, if a hotel wants to charge a resort fee, let them charge a resort fee. You know, it's like it's a free market. They have, you own the hotel, you can charge whatever you want. You can label the fees however you want to label them. And if customers want to pay them, they'll pay them. If not, they'll go someplace else. But, you know, the government has no business attacking anybody else for deceptive advertising. Everything they do is deceptive advertising.
Got it. So true. And you just look around and you see the waste taking place by the government. I mean, most of this money is wasted, and there is no way that you efficient government is the biggest oxymoron around.
Well, government can never be efficient because nobody is efficient with somebody else's money. That's impossible. You're going to be extravagant. I mean, who washes a rental car, right? You don't go and change the oil, right? It's not your car. You don't care about it. So, you know, the government doesn't care about spending other people's money. In fact, they want to spend as much of other people's money as they possibly can. You know, they're incentivized to be extra extravagant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true. Like you say, nobody washes a rental car. Nobody's changing the oil. And you're lucky if it gets returned with four tires on it.
Yeah, especially if it's a manual. I mean, Imagine what happens to the clutch. I mean, people like, you know.
No, that's why they've gotten rid of them. It's too hard for the millennials to figure out how to run a standard transmission. That just doesn't work. Push a button. Hey, so looking at what's happening with AI, all right, do you have any insights, anything you see personally in the financial industry? Is it really a cause for concern, or are we just worrying about nothing here?
Well, look, I don't think innovation progress is ever a cause for concern. Now, can individuals be concerned about how it may impact them in the short run? Sure. I mean, you could look at artificial intelligence. I mean, maybe in the financial services industry, you can say, well, you know, we could replace financial advisors, you know, with just computers. And, you know, for the type of advice that you get from most financial advisors, you're not going to notice the difference because it's all robotic anyway. But, you know, the computers only know what they've been programmed to know. And, you know, so I don't feel threatened that somebody's going to replace me with AI, but maybe I'll be able to replace some of my employees with artificial intelligence. But that will just make my business more efficient, and I'll be able to pass that on to other people, my customers, and, you know, with a lower fees. But, you know, whenever you have an advancement, to the extent that we can create a computer program that can do a lot of mundane tasks, let's say programming, let's say we can have computers that are intelligent enough to write code for programs, and now we don't need all these coders. Okay, well, you know, that frees up all these smart people who have been spending their time coding. Now they can do something else with their intelligence that the computer can't do. You know, it goes back to the beginning of, you know, of machines. You know, people were always afraid, oh, you're going to put people out of work, right? Somebody, invented a bulldozer, and, oh, you're going to put out of work a lot of people who were digging with shovels. Well, that's true, but shovels put out a lot of people who were digging by hand. You know, the shovel was a big improvement. Should they have never had the shovel because it destroyed jobs? You didn't need as many people to dig? No. And then they shouldn't destroy the bulldozers and all these other earth-moving equipment that made labor more productive. So all of this artificial intelligence is going to make humans more productive. I think the absolute goal of humanity will be a society where machines do everything. And we don't have to do anything if we don't want to. Right, where you just live a life of leisure, or you pursue things that are gratifying, mentally stimulating, physically stimulating, you know, things that you want to do. But all the mundane tasks could be done by computers, by machines. You know, why should we have to do these things if, you know, we can invent a machine that's going to do it? Because they're not going to get bored. They don't care how many times they have to repeat a task.
No coffee breaks.
It's like they don't matter, right? And of course, you know, they're not going to sue you. You know, you can't sexually harass them or discriminate against them.
You could try. Right?
I mean, they're just going to, they're going to do what needs to be done, and they're not going to complain.
Hey, totally agree. Your take, Elon Musk. All right. Let's put the subsidies aside. Everybody's subsidized in this world today. If we weren't subsidized, you know, everything would be better. What is your take on him as far as who he is? Twitter, Tesla Motors, SpaceX. Is he friend or foe?
Well, look, he's obviously a extremely intelligent guy, very eccentric. And look, you know, you got to admire all of the accomplishments that he's had. I mean, especially even at the age that he is, he's accomplished a tremendous amount. You know, was buying Twitter a good financial move? I don't think so. I didn't think so from the beginning, which is one of the reasons I thought that he was just bluffing. I thought he was smart enough to know. But I think, you know, and he mentioned this himself, when you get to the point where you're the richest man of the world, at least he was momentarily because of the overpriced Tesla stock that he owned. But you do a lot of things, even if money is not the issue. And I don't know that money was the motivating factor behind Twitter. And so he spent some of his money in order to own Twitter. And hopefully he can turn it around and cause it to stop losing money so that it can be a sustainable business, even if it's not worth what he paid. Although, of course, you know, he sold a lot of overpriced Tesla stock to raise the money. So, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, you know, he's probably, it's all funny money as far as he's concerned. And, you know, he's got enough money that if Twitter goes to zero, it's not going to impact his standard of living at all. Right. He, you know, he can certainly afford to do that. But, you know, he's a bright guy. I mean, a lot of times I think that he's joking about things. You know, I think he's got an interesting sense of humor, especially when it comes to the cryptocurrency space. I think a lot of people want to take him seriously, but I think I get the jokes that he's telling and the points he's trying to make, subtly though, but he's making them. But you know, I think that we probably, if he and I sat down and had a conversation, I think we would agree on far more than we disagree. I think that Elon Musk sees the world in many ways through a similar prism. I mean, I did have an opportunity to have a long conversation with his mother one day. She was out here in Puerto Rico, and I met her, you know, at one of the restaurants by the pool. A lovely, lovely woman. And yeah, I mean, maybe one of these days I'll be able to have a conversation with Musk as well.
I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that. Yeah, I don't think the guy could care less about money. Besides a private jet, he doesn't seem to have a lot of the accoutrements of wealth.
Well, I'm sure he cares about money, and you know, I don't think that he was sheerly motivated by altruism, you know, the way Bankman-Fried pretended to be. Yeah. But you know, once you have a certain amount of money, it's, you know, it's not as important, I guess. You know, I don't think I'm at that point where I have so much money that more isn't meaningful. Now, small amounts are not as meaningful, but you know, $1 billion to me would be a meaningful sum. But it's probably immaterial to Elon whether he had an extra billion or not, because you know there's only so many submarines that you can put on your yacht, right? If that's what you want, I mean, you're going to run out of stuff to buy.
Yeah, and he could go up and down in his net worth $10 billion in a day, and nothing has changed. So, but I do find it interesting. Like SpaceX, he's doing all these things in the private sector that NASA forgot how to do. And the concept of reusable boosters and making space affordable, and then Starlink with all the internet service all over the world.
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Well, I've got Starlink. I have several internet sources here in Puerto Rico just to have backups for my backups, but one of them is Starlink, and Starlink worked really well for me when we had power for a week. We had no power at all. I was on generator, but we didn't, you know, some of my other internets were down. Starlink worked really well. But yeah, I mean, I would much rather have the private sector in space, you know, whether it's Jeff Bezos or Musk, than NASA. I mean, you know, because NASA is not going to approach it on a cost-benefit analysis because it's not their money. They don't give a damn how much it costs to send somebody to the moon. But if Elon Musk is going to be doing something, or Jeff Bezos, they're looking at the commercial value, and they're either investing their own money or investors are putting the money up, but they're putting the money up because they believe they can get a return. Because if the government does something and they don't care what it costs, they're willing to waste money, that's a net loss for society because resources are being used on a space program that could have been used someplace else. There's not an unlimited amount of resources. And so whatever we devote to a space program is at the expense of something else. And so if it's not going to, put out more than it consumes in terms of resources, then we're poorer as a result of having spent the money. But to the extent that Elon Musk can find a way to do something in space that generates a positive return, then those resources weren't wasted. We actually have something to show for the expenditure of those resources. But you're never going to get that type of positive risk reward analysis coming from a government. That's why you want to limit to the greatest degree possible what government does. And you want to allow the private sector to do as much as possible. And that includes, you know, infrastructure. You had Biden last night talking about how we want the government to spend more on infrastructure. No, I don't. They'll waste money. They'll build the proverbial bridge to nowhere. Only a politician would build a bridge to nowhere. No private citizen is going to waste money building a bridge to nowhere. How's he going to make any money off that bridge? Who's going to pay to use it? So, you know, it's not like we won't have infrastructure if the government doesn't provide it. In fact, a lot of the infrastructure, look at the New York subway system. That was built by the private sector. The government just took it over. They didn't build it. So we would have plenty of infrastructure if the government stayed out of infrastructure. We would have better infrastructure. It would be, more economically viable.
And better built and better placed. Hey, so the space program under NASA compared to Tesla is similar to the person washing the rental car before they return it. NASA just shoots stuff up into space. And aside from the astronauts, they don't really care if it comes back or not. Musk, on the other hand, sees that, hey, this is costing me money to produce junk to float around space. If I bring it back to Earth, I can use it again. And it's the perfect example, right?
Of course. You know, so if there is a purpose for being in outer space, then the free market will take advantage of it, you know. And at least if there's not a purpose, you know, they can't make any money, they'll stop going up there. Now, of course, you know, at some point in time, space will be a lot more economical, to exploit because we'll have better technology. And, you know, humans at some point, I'm sure, will be spacefaring civilization. There will be an economical way to get up there. There may be valuable resources that we can harvest from asteroids or other planets. We may, in fact, need other planets, you know, in 100 million years or maybe a lot sooner than that especially if these climate change people are right. But you know, maybe we'll need more planets, and but by the time we need them, hopefully, you know, I guess mankind will be able to get there. I mean, you and I aren't going to know about it, you know, but I mean, at some point, yeah, I don't, you know, they'll be able to use space. But, so far it doesn't seem that we've encountered anybody from any other solar system who's been able to get here. So it seems that it's not that easy to do, or we're very rare in the galaxy.
Or they're hiding it on us.
Hey. Although maybe those distances are just too vast, you know, I don't know if maybe no one's figured out how to travel those types of distances yet.
If they have, the government's hiding it from us anyway, and that I don't even want to go down.
They're not smart enough to hide it from us, you know.
What about Roswell?
You give them too much credit if you think that there's UFOs or the government is hiding it. It's like, yeah.
That's funny. Hey, so I'm just going to read you what the OpenAI said about you, and you're going to laugh at the end.
Oh, what did you ask it?
I just said Peter Schiff, Euro Pacific, and that's it. So it said, Peter Schiff is an American financial analyst and commentator. He is the chief economist and strategist at Euro Pacific Capital, a full-service investment firm that provides a range of financial products and services. Schiff is known for his bearish views on the U.S. economy and his advocacy of international investing, particularly in precious metals and foreign currencies. It's important to note that individual investment advice can vary widely, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listen, before making any investment decisions, it's always a good idea to do your own research and consult with a financial advisor. They have that every financial person I put in there.
But it's not even giving advice. Why is it even? I guess they're afraid of getting sued somehow, so they're putting disclaimers everywhere. But you know, the one thing about it is. Because, yeah, it only has data up to a certain point. And I've changed my affiliation, so it doesn't know that. Because now you can see that I'm now the chief strategist for Euro-Pacific Asset Management rather than Euro-Pacific Capital. But I made that change after they shut down the data into that program. Because it's not, you know, it's not getting any new information.
I didn't know that. Now we know why.
But the interesting thing is, ask it. Like I would, you know, I haven't gone on it yet, but I got to ask it. Like, you know, who's the most famous gold bug, or who's the biggest critic of crypto? And I wonder if it picks me. Like, because you know, to ask it to use its
reasoning,
its judgment. Yeah. But my son does a lot of funny things. He sent me some of the stuff he's done because he asks the program to. Concoct a hypothetical conversation between me and somebody else, and he picks the people, and it's very funny, you know, or write a short story, or you know, an essay, you know, how would Peter Schiff interact with, and it's funny because the programming learns a little bit about me quickly, learns about the other person, and then has to come up with a way that we might interact with one another and what we might say to each other. But then he'll say. But Peter Schiff is drunk. He's had a lot to drink, or this guy, you know, it's just like, and then they can throw in those variables.
Oh, that's great. So listen to this. It just did it. It's difficult to determine who the most famous gold bug is, as the term is often used to describe individuals who hold a strong belief in the value of gold as a form of investment and hedge against economic uncertainty. Some well-known individuals who are associated with this philosophy include Peter Schiff.
Oh, so I'm number one.
Mark Faber. Yeah. However, it's important to note that investment strategies and opinions can vary widely, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Before making any investment decisions, it's always a good idea to do your own research.
Yeah, you read that already.
Financial advisor.
I didn't even notice that because I haven't spent any time doing that. But yeah, because people often ask me, who do you think the biggest, you know, gold guy is? And I think it's me. I mean, I think, you know,
you're up there.
I wasn't at the beginning because I remember who the top gold guys were when I was younger. But now those guys have gotten old. Maybe some of them have passed away. And so now I'm still around. But, you know, I think one of the reasons that I'm so well known now for gold actually is because of crypto, because all these crypto people now know about me as a gold bug that doesn't like crypto. So they, you know, I'm just the old fashioned, you know, grandpa holding on to my horse and buggy. So I'm probably the only gold person they know, because they know me because I'm anti-crypto, and they know me from that, you know.
I call them kleptocurrencies.
But gold, I mean, because gold, I like gold. I'm an advocate of the gold standard. I believe in sound money. I believe people should have gold. But my primary business is not gold. It's asset management. Gold represents an allocation within my overall strategy. But, you know, it's not really part of my asset management business. I tell people to buy gold. I help them buy gold. Although in my strategies and in my funds, we do have investments in gold related equities, gold mining companies, silver mining companies. So in that respect, I've introduced an element of gold into my strategy because I think there's a lot of value in these stocks. But still, that sector is a minority of my portfolios, right? I mean, my portfolios, other than my gold fund, I have a strategy that's 100% gold, right? For people who want to have that in their portfolio, I do have strategies that are all gold. But in my strategies that are broader and just try to create a diversified portfolio of assets, they will have an allocation to gold stocks, whether that's 10% or 15%, you know, might depend on, you know, the stocks themselves. But my core strategies, my value and dividend payer strategies, they both have allocations to gold. And the allocations could vary from time to time. In fact, if gold stocks ever got really expensive, they would have no gold stocks in them. But, you know, since I've been managing these funds, these strategies, I've never really, you know, come into contact where a point where I thought gold stocks were really expensive, even though they have had some pretty big drops. I didn't think they were very expensive, you know. They weren't cheap. There were times I didn't think they were cheap. Although now, I still think they're very cheap, not only in relation to gold, but in relation to, you know, their own historic prices and a lot of the other metrics. But, you know, by the way, too, last year, those my two core strategies delivered positive returns, which was rare for 2022. I mean, we had a bear market, one of the worst years ever for stocks and bonds. And my two core strategies that were 100% long stocks had positive returns. They weren't big numbers. Now, they would have been much bigger numbers, but for the strength of the dollar. I mean, the dollar weakened in the fourth quarter, but it was still up, you know, about 10% on the year. And when all of my stocks are foreign, that means I have to go up 10% to break even because I have to overcome the dollar strength. But, you know, the core belief of my strategy and what I'm basing it on is that I think the dollar is going to go way down. That hasn't happened yet. But when it does happen, and I believe it will happen, and maybe this year will be the beginning of it, this could be the worst year ever for the dollar, we'll see, or one of the worst years. But then that's going to be a huge tailwind for my strategy. So my strategies did very well in an up market for the dollar, but I think they'll do much, much better, certainly on an absolute basis. Not last year was great relative return, not necessarily absolute return, but on a relative basis. In fact, U.S. News and World Report, they looked at 350 large cap international value funds. They didn't even realize there was, you know, that many of them, 350. So it's a big sample. And then they ranked the top 60. And I got number one and I got number three. So somehow Goldman Sachs managed to edge me out for number two. Hopefully I'll beat them this year and I'll be number one and number two.
All right. Well, we'll see. Hey,
but past performance is no guarantee of future results.
So. Well, I was going to mention that because you didn't break the top three on crypto or cryptocurrencies. The top three were Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon, and Nouriel Roubini. So maybe
I'm not in the top three critics of crypto.
No, you're not.
I can't believe I'm way bigger than Nouriel.
Yeah, well, sure. You think, but
ask it to name the top five. Let's see if I can see if it gets me in there.
We can do that. We'll just do one more. top five crypto.
Can't believe I won this award for the word. I remember from some.
Yeah, well, she's just not doesn't like it. Nah, I can't run it. I've run too many searches.
But I mean, Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon, I mean, those are big, those are well-known critics of crypto among people who don't own crypto. So let's say you ask somebody who's never heard of Bitcoin or, you know, I don't know, never bought it. Maybe they've heard of it, but they're not in the game. They might mention Jamie Dimon or a Warren Buffett. But I think if you went to like a hardcore crypto guy that's owns it, and you asked him for the top critic, that guy or gal would say me.
Yeah. here we go. So it changed its mind here. And I'm sorry, you're still not in the top 10.
Oh, listen, I'm not in the top 10.
No, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger is now number two. Jamie Dimon, Nouriel Roubini, they just like him in there. Paul Krugman, Joseph Stiglitz, Muhammad El Arian, Bill Gates, Alan Greenspan, and Robert Shiller.
Yes, well, they're anti-Bitcoiner, right? But I don't think they're as much of anti as I am.
Probably.
But
not.
I think the main difference is, though, I'm the only one really of the group that's both a gold bug and anti-crypto.
Well, all right. So we'll
Jamie Dimon doesn't like gold either, right? Neither the war, you know, a lot of these guys are negative on gold too.
Yeah, we'll have to refine it, and we'll put it up in the show notes.
Well, I think it's wrong there. So I don't know how its programming is missing me.
Let me see if we can appeal the decision of the chatbot. Okay, maybe there is an AI tribunal where you get to dispute the results, kind of like appealing a strike from.
But it knows I don't like crypto based on the things my son have done. I mean, it knows I'm anti-Bitcoin or anti-crypto, so it knows that.
That's great. Well, we got to go.
But at least I'm number one for gold. So I guess that shows you how few people out there are advocating gold, because I'm like, I'm all I can come up with.
Oh, man. Hey, well, we got to get going now. But Peter, where is the best place to find your work these days and your podcast and all your work?
Well, you know, I do my podcast usually a couple times a week at Shift Radio. So you can listen at Shift Radio. You can go to my YouTube channel, Peter Schiff Show. Got a little over, 520,000 subscribers to the YouTube channel now. And I got a couple hundred thousand regular podcast listeners on all the platforms. So some people listen on YouTube, some people listen on Shift Radio, some people listen, you know, on iTunes or various other platforms where you can find podcasts. But I would suggest listening to them, telling your friends about them. You know, there's a lot of misinformation out there in the mainstream media. And so I think it's important for people to look for alternative sources, like, you know, what you're doing with your podcast, what I'm doing. So get more people to listen. I think I do a really good job of explaining things in a way that people can understand it, and then explain it to other people. Follow me on social media. You know, I'm on all of the various platforms, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. But I think Twitter is where I spend the most amount of time personally. Almost all the tweets are my own. I mean, sometimes, you know, Shift Gold puts out some tweets out there, but pretty much I do my own tweeting. I put some thought into the tweets and what I want to comment about. And, you know, I've got, you know, almost 920,000 followers. So, and there's a lot of engagement. I mean, I noticed this about my Twitter page. When you look at a tweet that I do and you look at the engagement, look at the comments, you look at the likes or the retweets, there are people that have millions of followers, you know, many more than I do, sure, that don't get anywhere near that kind of engagement. You know, they'll put out a tweet and, you know, barely anybody notices it. So I think the people that follow me are pretty active on Twitter, not just to comment to me, but commenting with one another. I mean, I look at, you know, somebody makes a comment and people comment on their comment. So there's a lot of engagement there. So, so follow me on Twitter. And but most importantly, if you've got the resources, become a client. You know, I think last year was a good year. I mean, a great year on a relative basis. In fact, we caught up to a lot of our competitors. You know, if you look at some of my funds a couple of years ago, they were at the bottom of the pack. They had one star, now five stars. You know, I've made up a lot of ground because I stuck to the fundamentals. I didn't chase momentum. I didn't just try to mimic an index and just try to make a little bit more than everybody else or lose a little bit less than everybody else. And I still think that most people most professional managers are completely misallocated with their strategies. The benchmarks are going to be a disaster. And so the people whose main goal is not to deviate from the benchmark, they're going to succeed in that goal, but they're going to fail in the goal that's most important, which is protecting the purchasing power of their clients. And it's purchasing power that you need to protect, because some managers could do a good job of protecting your principal, meaning that they don't lose money for you because they decide not to take any risk, but they end up taking the ultimate risk, and that is inflation. You know, because you could put a lot of money in cash and not lose any of your precious dollars, but wake up one morning and those dollars don't buy you very much because the people that have the stuff that you want to buy don't want your dollars anymore. And so I'm always looking at that risk in a portfolio, the risk of inflation, a decline of the dollar. And so for that reason, we're generally, you know, not 100% invested. I mean, we always keep a little bit of cash, some dry powder, but, you know, 90% plus of the money that I have under management is pretty much always invested. You know, and even though we were 100% invested last year, you know, in our core strategies, we still had a positive return. Some of my strategies, my gold fund, my emerging market fund had losses, but not that substantial. And most of those losses have already been recovered, right? They might have all been recovered already in 2023. But I think over the long term, I think we're still big, you know, well positioned for the big move, because the dollar is still higher than it was, you know, 10 years ago. The dollar has a long way to fall. And I think when it really starts to fall, it's going to happen quick. And so you've got to be prepared. You've got to be protected from that inflation tax that's going to eviscerate, I think, the vast majority of people's portfolios, but not mine. I mean, I think I've been preparing for this for a long time, and the pendulum is now swinging in my direction. I think the problems that I saw years ago, even before the 08 financial crisis, we're now starting to see the consequences, although most people still don't recognize what they see because they still don't understand the nature of the problem. Just like so many people were surprised by the 2008 financial crisis, it was because they didn't understand the problem. I wasn't surprised. I expected it because I understood what was going wrong. And that's why so many people believe that Fed policy was a success in the aftermath of 08. It wasn't a success. It was an abysmal failure. I know that because I understood the nature of the problem. They didn't solve anything. They made the problem worse. They just covered it with a Band-Aid of inflation. But now inflation has become such a problem that, you know, we're now at the end of our rope. And I think, again, eventually the Fed is going to pivot. They are going to try to stimulate again the economy by creating more inflation, because that's the only economic tool they have is inflation. You know, quantitative easing is just inflation. They just gave it a nicer name so that people wouldn't oppose it. But we're going to go back to that. But it's not going to work again. Not that it ever worked, but it's not going to make us high like it did before. We're just going to overdose on it, and inflation is going to go through the roof. You know, at least, you know, as measured by the CPI and PPI and those indexes.
Okay. All right. Well, if you got a question for Peter, shoot us an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Make sure you sign up for your free newsletter on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. We got a link to Peter's site there. Peter, always a pleasure. Good luck for the coming year, and we'll see what happens later on.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to Cary Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.